You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com. Welcome to the Chris Spangle Show. It is great to be with you today. It is another episode of one of my favorite series, The Swamp Explained, and I am joined by Rob Cortell, 45-year fly on the wall in Washington, D.C. Now, Rob has worked for Republican presidential campaigns, government agencies like the EPA, and has been confirmed in the Senate to the U.S. Federal Maritime Commission. He's also been a candidate for Congress and Senate, and he's spent years working in the private tech sector with startup companies. Now, given his experience and iconoclastic viewpoint, Rob gives us a great insight into the swamp that makes up our nation's capital. And we have a swampy episode today, Rob. This has been... there's a lot to unpack, I think, with Afghanistan and what's gone on, and Joe Biden's performance, and the swamp's performance, really. So where do we begin? I mean, what are your thoughts generally on the Afghan situation?
Well, yes, that's the big news of the week. There are going to be a couple things in sequence. You know, this is probably Joe Biden's worst week, as we all know, for quite a while. The Afghan debacle, pretty soon he's going to have to make sure the FEMA guys do their job in Louisiana. You know, we have a category hurricane crossing over to the west, so greater damage on the east side of these things, which is New Orleans. Now, he tried to redeem himself with a strike on ISIS last night.
I think he's misreading the American people. I think he wants us to see him as aggressive on this when that's not what everybody seems to want. They want all of our soldiers out of danger.
Well, yeah. So I would say the whole thing from the beginning was a mess. And, you know, there's a lot of finger pointing going on right now. You know, there are all the Trump people trying to distance themselves from the decision, you know, Esper and all these other guys. And then there's the question of why is it so screwed up? And of course, that's totally separate from the policy decision. You know, do we pull all the way out? Should we have pulled all the way out? And so, you know, Biden, first of all, blame this on Trump. You know, I couldn't do anything. Trump made a deal to pull everybody out. If I had reneged on the deal, we'd have been in big danger. Well, the deal was to pull up by May 1. And, you know, he already, quote, renegotiated it. So it was end of August. So it's not like he followed Trump's deal exactly. And I think it's worth pointing out that we had very few casualties in the last 10 years. Well, 9 years, probably 8 years. I think this is the most casualties we've actually had in one event in 10 years in Afghanistan.
Yeah, since 2011.
Yeah, 2011. And it's also so there are lots of things to unpack. Is it a good decision? Well, I think the population clearly wanted to be out. And I think Trump read that correctly. And I think Biden reads that correctly. But, you know, Biden also thinks he's the guru of foreign policy. Bob Gates, former Secretary of Defense in Democrat and Republican times, said he'd been wrong on every single foreign policy decision the last 40 years. Biden's a guy who wanted to split Iraq into three countries. He's a pessimist on whether or not other people can self-govern. He considers all these people in the Middle East as tribal. And yes, there's a lot of tribalism, but there's tribalism in our society too, and we manage to self-govern. So he's a pessimist, but he wanted to pull out. He lost that debate in the Obama administration. He wants to show he's president, and he's every bit as stubborn as Trump, in my view, on these kinds of things, right or wrong. So yes, he decided to pull out. I think there was a clear screw up on the handling of the logistics. You know, what a lot of the people like Petraeus have said is that the Afghan army really had no choice but to flee because they had no support, aerial support, no tactical support from the U.S. Military. The contractors who managed their helicopters and their equipment pulled out a couple weeks ago. And so if you were someone fighting and had no cover, what would you do? And of course, Biden has also essentially accused them of turning tail and running, and that's just not true.
Yeah. By the way, there's a little mic rattle, so I don't know if you're banging the table
sorry about
or
that.
Playing with a cord.
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm playing with a cord.
Yeah, right. I'm a fidgeter too. Yeah.
Good thing you can't hear my knees going.
Yeah, I know. I'm the same way. We have some fidget spinner or something. This is a really bad week or month for the most competent administration restoring competence and command. Yeah. And I just have to say, like, I saw the 25th Amendment stuff start to pop up on the Republican side. And, of course, you know, you start that under Trump, you're going to get it under Biden. And And there really does come a point where you look at your conservative friend and go, all right, well, how true is it that Biden's just not in command and just doesn't have the leadership skills, I guess we should say, to make this work? I mean, how would you evaluate that? Every administration messes up, or is he really just not grasping?
I think everybody messes up, but I think this is a monumental mess, and it's of his own making. You know, a lot of people have compared it to Bay of Pigs. I think it's worse than Bay of Pigs. Bay of Pigs was a tactical mistake. This is, in my opinion, on the order of Munich in 1939. He's basically pulled the rug out from a whole region of people who have counted on the U.S. and the Allies, and he pulled the rug out from under the Allies as well. You know, I think NATO and all the NATO guys, and from Turkey to England to France to all the rest, have been shocked by the whole thing.
And I am in favor of leaving. I was in favor of the decision. I was not in favor of how this was done. Do you agree with me on that?
I was in favor of leaving with a small force staying behind. Okay. And there are lots of ways you can leave and still keep forces on the ground. You know, if we had U.S. anything there, that would have held back the Taliban, and I think that they would have given the government and other people time to have talks and deal with this. Of course, now we have the interesting problem: the Taliban didn't expect to roll through so fast, so
right.
They have no ability to govern either, and you know they have lost control of their troops. You know, you have these spokesmen saying, "Well, wait, women should stay inside for a little bit because we have a lot of young guys who are not used to that. They're from the villages, and you know they're used to treating women differently, and so." That's an indicator, if you just take them at face value, that they don't have control. But frankly, they don't have control. They don't have bureaucrats. That's why they're asking the Afghan government people to stay in. But, of course, they're telling government women to stay at home.
And, right.
So they don't have administrators.
And, this feels like they're playing it cool because if people want to leave, let them leave. Why leave destabilizing people here? And they'd probably let us take as many people as we want because they don't, you know, everybody's sort of, they'll start hanging people and shooting people. It's like, no, they're going to wait until everybody's not paying attention to them. And then
I think they need a lot of these bureaucrats and administrators. Yeah. And they just, they've got a problem on their hands. Their problem is a different kind than we have. But it's also not true that they're not connected with Al-Qaeda and ISIS. You know, they're symbiotic and they can make all the claims they want, but Al-Qaeda has been operating out of there the entire time, and ISIS has been operating out of there the entire time, and maybe ISIS doesn't like them very much and vice versa, but they're all in it together, and I think they're problematic for them too. But back to the instant case, I think most people would like to have gotten out, but I think rational people know you can get out and leave a stabilizing group behind, whether it's contractors or aid workers or something else. The fact of the matter is people like the Taliban and others don't want to attack. You know, it would be enough to have stabilized the Afghan government, a lot of people think, and left the contractors in to provide the tactical air force and on and on and on. But, you know, they didn't, and it fell. And, you know, the conversation I was having on the Council on Foreign Relations several weeks ago, it was about 10 days before it all collapsed. On that date, it was the Deputy Secretary of Defense. It was a woman. And she began the whole conversation talking about how fabulous it was that we had trained all these women. The women were finally free. They were educated through college. They were training doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs. And I'm, you know, how in the Zoom you have a little box at the bottom you can type in your comments. And I typed in my comment was, oh, it's great that we've, you know, educated all these women, but what's going to happen in 2 weeks and the whole government falls and they're either dead or fled? And nothing happened. And then I happened to be the second person called on. And she says, oh, you were the guy who made that comment. I said, that's exactly right. And now I'd like to hear you answer the question, because the reality is they're going to fall because we pulled everybody out. And it's going to be faster than we think. It's going to be probably in 2 weeks. And what are you going to be saying then when we're trying to get out all these people? Are you ready for that? And it was kind of mumble, mumble. Sure, we'll be ready for any exigency. And we don't think it's going to happen like that and blah, blah, blah. And then I'm getting bombarded by generals and admirals and former ambassadors in the chat box. Thank you for asking that question. You were right.
that's the great thing about military people is I am non-interventionist, but I love the military people that serve. I love, like, they are the most, they make up the biggest bulk of the We Are Libertarians podcast network audience is former vets, because they deal with the incompetence and these experts like this woman
too.
Right. Yeah. These people, like the experts on Afghanistan and the war on terror for 20 years have been wrong. They're focusing on women, and that is important. It's not like the humanitarian crisis that is unfolding is happening to everybody, and it's like we should stay there to support women's rights in Afghanistan. The American people don't want wholesale slaughter, but they also don't want their troops at risk. They don't want their brothers and sisters at risk.
I think everybody's conflicted, you know, in how they feel about this. I mean, the reality is, and of course, they were also glad that somebody asked the question, because being the swamp, they didn't want to put their reputations on the line by asking it or saying it themselves. And I don't care. I'm known for asking tough questions, the ones that everybody else is thinking but afraid to talk about. But in any case, so obviously I was right, and there were other people that were right, and it was predictable it would fall, you know.
What are those people saying now? Like, what's the
not my fault,
right?
I mean, Esper and all of them, now they're finger pointing to Trump, but they were there. And, you know, I'm reading this, the book, what's the newest one on the Trump administration by the husband-wife team? I can't think of the name, but anyway, it's the last year and what a debacle it was. And you got everybody, Esper on, talking about how they did everything they could to keep their fingers in the dike and keep it from becoming a junta and all of that. And I actually never thought it would be that. Just I think all the forces against that are pretty strong. But in any case, so now we are where we are. And, you know, so we have 13 American soldiers dead. And as of this morning, 170 Afghans and a couple Brits, British soldiers. And, you know, they're expecting another attack. And they're leaving, you know, thousands of interpreters behind. But the reality is it's not just the interpreters. It is like the 6 million people who live in Kabul, who have, and this, that city in particular and that country in particular, have tasted self-government. And, you know, there was a great article this morning in the New York Times that had 8 or 10 Afghans talking who had grown up under this over the last 20 years. And, you know, they have a different point of view. And I think that will present a problem for the Taliban to govern. They can be repressive. I personally would have handed out a gun to every man and woman, and including women, in Kabul, and said, you know, defend yourself.
Good luck. Yeah. That's actually not a bad idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I was watching a documentary this morning about Afghanistan before the Taliban and how cosmopolitan it was. They had jazz clubs. I mean, I tweeted that out. I'll put it in the show notes. But, you know, the elites in Kabul generated a lot. I mean, we all know how Americans feel about elites, and that conversation, it was very similar. And so these guys look like they were going to punish the people I don't like. And so that's how they took power. It seems like a much different, you know, takeover now than it was then. So I'll be interested to see if they're able to govern.
Well, that was on top of the Soviets. Now, you remember, the Soviets actually deliberately educated women and everything else, which is one of the things that sparked the Taliban, you know, and the Muslim. And at the time, they were much more, they were much different across society. The issue today is it's not just the elites, and that's part of the point of this article. It's everyday people, girls, are going to school and able to rise who are not part of the elites. So the elites, you know, we want to characterize it frequently as a defense. Well, it's just the elites, and they can always get out. But it is not just the elites who now are who have a problem. And oh, by the way, it's not over for the Taliban. So they've got a major, you know, tribal leader in one of the provinces has collected an army, and I suspect there are an awful lot of the military running over there to work with him. So they've got a big shooting match in their own backyard still. Of an army, you know, one of the regional tribal chiefs, and so, this thing is not over. They're not completely in charge of the government. They're not completely in charge of their own troops, their own forces. And calling them all troops is kind of a stretch.
Right.
You know, they're probably half of them trained and half, you know,
it's like
dragged
the three,
out of the villages.
3 percenters got control of the government.
Right. So there's going to be a lot of chaos, and I think there'll be a lot of chaos along all the borders. But what we did is unforgivable. I think everybody who has ever experienced military or anybody in foreign policy or anything is convinced that we could have done this more rationally. We should have expected that this was what would happen, that the Taliban would be able to march in because the people in charge of many of these places are corrupt and they took bribes and they're watching out for themselves. And then, of course, we pulled out support and cover via the contractors and on and on and on. And I think one thing you should do is post that article by Henry Kissinger, which is sort of strategic, and the one by David Petraeus, which is really very analytical. And he and others, I know, have argued that we should put a small force back in there and just keep it there. But it's, or we could have, and it's just too late. And Biden, and again,
the American people will never accept because you will have
shooting. We can't put anybody back in now.
Yeah,
no, can't put anybody back.
No, there's no way.
We could have kept 1,000 troops in there and people. You know, we have troops in Somalia and Libya and all over Africa, and we still have thousands of troops in Germany and Korea and all these other places today. And I assure you, if we took them out of Korea, there would be a shooting match. And if we took them out of some of these other places, there would be more shooting matches. And guess what? We will be sending people in to Afghanistan from other places to deal with al-Qaeda and ISIS and all the rest of them who will pop up. It's just, it is inevitable, and it will be messier than if we had had a body of 1,000 troops in there just kind of maintaining equipment and helping the army strategize and the government, you know, and it's a slow process. So Iraq is rife with corruption. But its government stabilizes. It's more stable than they've had. It is more representative than they've had. It is free elections. Afghanistan was getting there. These things take time. We had, as a country, hundreds of years before we were an independent country and able to self-govern. And even then, there were issues. And, you know, I'm reading another book about the founders who were kind of after 20 years after the revolution and the Constitution, just were just not sure this country would survive because of strife and factionalism and all of those things. And they called that factionalism in those days.
Right.
And today we call it partisan. But, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and all these countries are going through factionalism. And it's a growth process. But
so let's
blew it.
Let's continue the blame game down to the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And I think an interesting question that I've heard from so-called experts was Trump wanted to withdraw, and the foreign policy and defense swamp basically drug their feet. And
right.
If they had actually taken him seriously instead of waiting and hoping that Biden would reverse that win and reverse that decision— that this wouldn't be as much of a catastrophe because there would be plans in place, that they failed to plan because they disobeyed the president, which is a breakdown of norms that continued under Biden, it seems like. How much credence do you give that argument?
Well, probably some. But I think it's clear from all of the telltales coming out of the administration that Trump wanted to be out of all these places by the end of his first term, and if not earlier. And they dragged it out. And, you know, Obama wanted to be out and couldn't get out. And part of that is because the foreign policy establishment has a different long-term view than I think politicians. And you see inside the political establishment some people who have a long-term strategic viewpoint as well, but not a lot. John McCain had it. Romney and others have it. There are some in the House, and the Democrats certainly have it too, who would like to see a peaceful, stabilized world. They don't believe the world can stabilize itself without us. And so you're correct.
Why is that? Because that's a common, libertarian idea, is that we need to leave South Korea. We need to leave all of these places. Why are we in 170 countries? Why do they believe that if we leave those places, the world would destabilize?
Well, this is the lesson of World War II and the nation, and not, well, there was some nation building after World War II. And, these things build on themselves. Think back to the period between World War I and World War II and the League of Nations, which essentially was utterly impotent. And we tried to punish Germany. The reparations was one of the key drivers of the angst inside Germany itself that led to the rise of Hitler. And from there, we then had World War II, which was massive. That was massively destructive. Millions of people died in this, and the terror of it, and the unleashing of nuclear war, and all that. And so the lesson to those people was somebody needs to be in charge here, and America is probably the strongest, greatest nation in the history of mankind, and I still think that's probably still true. And then over the years, people have tried to, and so they build institutions. They built the United Nations, which is utterly impotent, and then they built the monetary institutions like the World Bank and the IFC and all of these, which actually are more influential because they go right in and say, "I'll give you money if you do X, Y, or Z." And if you don't,
I'd also argue that the nuclear weapon didn't exist after World War I, and that is a strategic thing that keeps people from hot wars, basically.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so, these things just build on themselves over time. And the lesson out of World War II was we need to build institutions that are critically important to other people and countries, and that the only way to do it is together. And again, we also had them and us. We had the Russians and the communists versus us, and the godless communists, against the God-fearing Americans and blah, blah, blah. And so that was another part of the equation. And as the world becomes more secular, that part of the equation doesn't fit as well. But it's we thought it was all one. What was the book?
Right.
The End of History.
Yeah. Right.
And that it was going to be all bliss. And then 3 years later, we had another war. And then 9/11 and on and on and on. So I think that people from the strategic side of foreign policy, and this is, you can call it the swamp, or you can call it experts, or you can call it elites, or whatever, really would like to see less strife and less economic strife. And all these things are interconnected. And some institutions that have been built over the last 70-some years work reasonably well, and others don't. I mean, the United Nations works as an aid organization, but they don't work as a peace organization. I wonder to myself, why couldn't someone have said to the UN, go in there and put your own troops? Of course, their troops are our troops, in front of it all. And you know, if you leave countries to settle their own problems, they don't. You know, we're watching the Saudis and the Somalis and the
Americans
and the Americans and the Israelis and the Palestinians and, you know, and on and on and on. And it just it's issues that are narrow inside countries are hard to overcome. And
do you think that our focus is too big? Like, do you think that the old world idea of grand powers and our focus needs to be on what Israel's doing, what Afghanistan is doing, instead of focusing locally on what we're doing, is kind of a that philosophy is sort of the, you know, an old world way of thinking as opposed to thinking more small. Like, do you understand what I'm saying? Like,
well,
the idea that nations have to control each other is outdated.
Yeah, well, that is, you know, there's this whole peace through strength thing. That's my birria clicking in the background. I'm making, you know, Mexican birria, which is you Ooh. Poach short ribs in liquid and anchos and other kinds of things, and then you boil it down and you add more spice.
Perfect.
And you put it in tacos. I'm hoping it's going to stop beeping in a minute.
No, you're
if it
okay.
doesn't, I'm going to...
You can barely hear it. Yeah, I mean,
let me turn that around on you.
Okay.
If you have when you have a problem that you want to solve, a social problem, do you try to solve it yourself or do you try to get other people to help you in your community?
Yes. I think that the idea that in the internet age, in an age of capitalism, the idea that foreign policy and wars, most specifically, are the first tools in, I think is kind of an outdated way of thinking. I think if you have to have foreign policy and diplomacy and conversations and some mechanism for dealing with bad actors, right? You know, if you have a bad actor in your life, you need people around you to help, like, escape that situation or end that, right? Like, so, but I think the old world, their first, you look at World War I and the lead up to that, the idea was, well, we just start shooting at each other. Like, we're going to have to go to war. And I think we've evolved over the last 100 years into thinking, all right, how can, I mean, China was the great example, right? Like, if we open up economically and allow, you know, marketplaces to connect, then obviously bad actors will disappear because people's financial interest overrule their desire for violence. I don't know that has
And then the Chinese saw what happened to the Soviet Union and right. decided that if they didn't exert themselves as a Chinese Communist Party, they would not be able to survive. They saw that. They were threatened by, you know, the riots and everything else and all of those things, and they learned their lesson. So they're moving to contain economic individualism. Well, economic individualism they're happy to have.
Right.
Because it makes all these people independently happy down at the low level, but it's not so happy at the top.
They're starting
they want
to close
control.
Off. You're going to see this.
Control.
My fiance has been making her living teaching VIP Kid, which is teaching English to Chinese students, and they completely shut down the tutoring industry over the last month, and she lost her job because they're hiring only Chinese tutors to teach English now. And part of the thinking is that they don't want Western people talking to Chinese people. They want to close off that conversation because they don't, you know, I mean, and it's not a wealth thing. Like, she was in a closet in her apartment teaching kids with chandeliers in their bedroom. But I just think they wanted to sever that connection between, you know, a white American that they loved, that they liked, that they're sad isn't teaching them anymore, and wanted to, you know, drive that idea of nationalism that Chinese are superior, and so these
teachers
are better.
Well, the people that will ultimately harm are the Chinese trying to learn English, because
right.
English is we think of Chinese as complex. It's mainly because we're not used to the types of sounds and all of the rest of that. But English is incredibly irregular and nuanced and really is an amalgam of dozens and dozens of other languages. So the nuance of English is where, you will see it. And I frequently in my past have had native Chinese speaking English and miss the mark because they don't understand the nuance of that. And,
yeah.
And that will ultimately harm them. So,
all right. So while
it's not good for your fiance.
No, it's not. But we've got other plans. So I saw an interesting point from a rabid Democrat that Donald Trump didn't protect the Kurds. And so therefore, all of the idea that Trump would have done better is sort of stupid because he didn't protect our allies then. Why would we think that he would do this now? How much blame do you put on Trump? Do you agree with that person's assessment?
I don't think Trump would have done it better. I mean, a lot of the same people. There's no one in who was in the Trump administration in a position in the defense or the professional State Department other than maybe Pompeo who wouldn't have seen it or done it differently. You know, I think the reality is that everybody would like to have pretended they were not going to fall. And it is possible they would have done it a little more regularly and maintained the contractors in. But frankly, I suspect the Biden people would prefer to have maintained it in a different sequence. And, you know, they were driven by the president to move it out. And so that was a mistake. And I don't think it's a mistake that the Trump people would not have made. And I take all the Esper and all the rest of these guys with a grain of salt.
You don't trust Mike Pompeo?
Pompous Pompeo, right? He wants to be president, and he's running around the country. We have a governor's election here in Virginia. Terry McAuliffe is trying to get back in. Speaking of the swamp creature, is coming back.
Yeah, kidding.
You know, and the last time Terry ran as a businessman and an outsider, and now he's running as a knowledgeable insider who did a great job, you know, 4 years ago. And Glenn Youngkin is running as the outsider, and Glenn, and I know them both, you know, neither one incredibly well, but Youngkin a little better. And he's the Republican. Of course, he's being he has the problem of trying to motivate the Trump guys. And win the moderates and centrists and the regular Republicans. And so what he
trying to appeal north of Richmond and south of Richmond is a hard balancing act.
It is. It's a very hard balancing act. And you know, they ran a convention here I forgot what they call it, but drive up convention. Basically, you drove up to a public site and you stayed in your cars and voted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in order of your sequence of your preferences. And I was at the local Republican meeting about a week ago, and where, let me say that these people, by and large, they're not conservatives. They are right of Attila populists, most of them. But one of them was standing up saying, well, what a stupid system. It kept our candidate from winning, and that's the elites in Richmond in the party, and the woman who is the head of elections here is a Republican. She said, well, they were your party officials. And he said, well, they're elites, and who is this Youngkin guy anyway? I mean, why should we vote for him? And everybody else, people like me, are mumbling, because if you don't vote for him, you're going to get Terry McAuliffe.
Right.
So, anyway, so it's... But, it's going to be a problem for him, too, because he's got to motivate these people to get out. And Virginia is a very close state. I think Youngkin can win. He's within striking distance of Terry, and it's all going to be about get out the vote, I think. But Terry's now running ads that Youngkin is a clone of Trump. Anyway, it's interesting.
So that's
the swamp here.
Yeah. So let's hop to the future. I think the midterms are going to be a bloodbath for Democrats. I think that I think that people in the media and in Washington D.C. have no idea the amount of the resentment that a lot of Americans feel over the vaccine debate. I think is going to play out in a very big way in the midterms. Nobody sees it yet. But you're going to see it, and there'll be all these think pieces of what happened. Why did Biden lose so big? Was it Afghanistan? I think the vaccine thing will not be seen by the media because they have an agenda. But I think Afghanistan's going to loom large, and I think Afghanistan is going to play big in Biden's reelection. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that this is very few times you break. I don't know. I think when you break,
I'm not sure he's going to run again.
Oh, that's a good point. I mean, so what do you see happening? How does this play out politically in the short and long term?
Well, I think your general points I agree with. I think that it's bad for him on the midterms. I think that a lot of people who were on the fence and didn't vote for Trump will definitely vote, you know, Biden. And we may remember that there were numerous districts that went for every other Republican but Trump. And so that's going to be problematic. I did see a number that the balances in the Senate are pretty close. And so the Senate may still be split. But, you know, there's a long time between now and November next year. I do think redistricting is really problematic for the Democrats. Republicans control more state legislative seats and outcomes of congressional seats than do Democrats in the redistricting. So that's going to be a problem for them. I do think that these laws in Georgia and Texas and other places are indeed meant to harass Democrats, not just blacks in general, but Democrats in general, and make it harder. So they're going to have to redouble theirs. On the other hand, we've got places like California where they sort of tilt in the other direction to make it easier for Republicans to lose. But I do think Afghanistan's going to loom large this fall. I think this strike, when I was thinking about the strike this morning on the ISIS troops, I think it was less than impressive. But to a lot of the public, it's going to look like, you know, Joe is out there doing what he said he would, which is not forgive or forget will get you where you are. And there'll probably be some more. And I'm sure he's hoping that will help recover some ground for him. And I also agree with you on the masking in schools. The fact that people are going back to school is, he's consistently taken the position people should go back to school. And, of course, everybody was hoping that it would all be over by now. And you know, the listeners don't know that I had a breakthrough case of COVID. I was vaccinated back in February, March, and went to a gathering about a month ago of 300 young tech entrepreneurs in Washington, in a beautiful building overlooking the city, and, you know, everybody was just joyous to see each other. We had not seen each other in person in a year and a half. And it was 300 people, of which 275 were under 35, and the remainder of us were over 50, and lawyers and venture capitalists and everything else. But part of it was inside. And a couple of days later, I came down with a little bit of a cough and a little bit of a sniffle, and didn't think much of it. And then a couple of days later, I had house guests. And by the end of the weekend, I'm thinking, I better get checked. And on Monday, I did, and I was positive. Mm. And ended up never had a fever, never had any consequences. The sniffle was gone in a week, and it was the other. But I had a trip planned to a wedding in Aspen at the end of the week, and we were going to Utah and Moab and all these great places, 108 degree dry heat. I couldn't wait.
Yeah.
And I made the mistake of getting retested on Thursday morning. The public health people said I could go on Friday, and I was positive again.
June was great, wasn't it? June was great.
Oh, July was bad.
Yeah, I mean, I went to Podcast Movement in the first week of August, and that's right when Delta was starting to trend, and it was, it was in the Delta wing of the Opryland Hotel, and, you know, it was really an uneasy experience, and the radio show host from Tennessee named Phil Valentine got it there and died, and that was just, I don't know.
That where he got it?
He did, allegedly, but that's, I think that's enough conventions for me for a while.
But you know what? I'm getting to the point, and I suspect most Americans are getting to the point. If you get it and you don't have a shot, it's your own fault. I am totally with this doctor who says, if you didn't get vaccinated, don't expect me to take you in ahead of my other patients. You know, my brother was supposed to have a knee operation, you know, replacement knee surgery, and he needs it. It got canceled because their hospitals are full of COVID patients. And, of course, I sent him a note. I knew I was trolling him, and I said, well, you can thank your moron governor, DeSantis. then he immediately goes in defense mode, you know, well, how about the morons in Washington who did this or that? And you know, you really can't – people are still defending their choices, and they defend the choice mm-hmm. even when their choice threatens somebody else's choice. And threatens people who don't have a choice. I mean, what about these people with little kids who can't get vaccinated? My granddaughter can't get vaccinated and she won't be on the next round because she's 4 and a half. And yet she wants to go to public school and public kindergarten, which is her right, and her parents pay the taxes for it. But she's going to be in class with kids whose parents aren't vaccinated and are therefore exposed and can give it to their kids who can give it to my granddaughter. Because they have a choice, but my granddaughter doesn't have a choice. And, you know, there was another article today about a school district. I think it may have been in Texas. The teacher was not vaccinated. I think it's the Times, New York Times again. Half of the kids in her class caught it from her. And of those 12 kids, one-third gave it to their families. And you see it in the broadcast. She read to the class without a mask, despite the fact that policy was read with a mask. And you can see a broadcast rim in the classroom of who got it and who did not get it. And so that is the best illustration to me of the problem. And I think a lot of the public is just fed up, and it's not just now Democrats, you know, it's Republicans and Democrats who have families and kids, and they're facing it real time. So, and I do think Biden was getting some positive lift, but the fact that he it's going back down, you know, I think he's losing momentum from that. And Afghanistan's been a big hit. He's, I think, at 44%. He was in the 50s before.
I saw 41.
41, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be all over the map. There's no question. His handling of this has been a debacle, and it's the execution is on his watch. And he can keep saying, well, my decision was right. And maybe 10 years from now, people will say your decision was right. But it's pretty hard to distract people from the deaths on our side and everybody else. But coronavirus is here too, and Delta, and we've lost control of Delta. And the fact is the country's become a petri dish with all of the unvaccinated people. They're just creating new varieties, and nobody can predict where they're going to go. The next one could maybe kill you in 3 days and get through a mask.
Yeah.
You know, viruses tend to get better, tougher, not easier.
I suspect that as it gets more and more dangerous, I think that is what will drive people who are unvaccinated to get vaccinated more than mandates. Mandates create resentment, but people think in terms of their personal safety. I'm doing a special, like, who are unvaccinated people? Like, what's their... Because this idea that they're all just mouth-breathing Trump people is just not true, and it's not
true.
And I see the doctor's point about, you know, why should I prioritize them over other people? I have a hard time thinking that that's a humane stance, but I have a problem with what unvaccinated people...
Well, I'm Darwinian about it.
Right. Fair enough. But the way that unvaccinated people are being treated right now reminds me of the way anti-war people were treated at the beginning of the Iraq war. Like that, just like, I really don't care what happens to you. You're not like a person to me because you're affecting my comfort and I don't like it. And I, I, want to fight against that notion, because I just think that is...
I don't think it's comparable, Chris. I mean, the reality is that the war thing is abstract to most people. The reality is, even in Vietnam, and remember years ago I was on the President Ford's clemency board, and we did a study of this. Even in Vietnam, only 3 million out of the hundreds of millions of Americans actually went to Vietnam. And yet, and so it was experienced in their immediate families and, you know, all that. But for most Americans, it was abstract and it was not a real threat. Every one of us of age in that period thought we were going to go over and get killed in a swamp. But the reality is it was really only like about, you know, one out of 10 who were eligible actually ever went, ended up in a swamp. So, so the same thing on... the beginning of the Iraq wars. That was as much then a political decision as anything else. And I really did, I do think that split very politically. And I had friends who would, I would see them and they would start yelling at me about George Bush, George W. Bush. And I just stopped seeing people like that because I really believe you can talk about anything in a reasonable tone. But this is really personal. This is the thing that you do, you meaning you in any you anybody out there, can affect me tomorrow. You know, if you decide not to be vaccinated, and a bunch of yous decide not to be vaccinated, and all of you happen to be in a grocery store when I'm in the grocery store, you could do something to help me not get it. And I could do something to help myself not get it. But why should I also not be in that grocery store and vaccinated and not wearing a mask? Well, the reason is because everybody else is unvaccinated and not wearing a mask. And you can kill me. You can kill me if you're unvaccinated. And that is what it's about. And I have a problem with that, you know. And as I say, I'm Darwinian. If you get it and you're unvaccinated for any reason, if you've got a medical reason, fine. Got a religious reason? Well, I pity the religion, but you know, that's a problem. But it's okay. But if you're unvaccinated because you don't trust the data, or there's not enough data, or I just don't want it, or it's my freedom against your freedom, I'm sorry. If you get sick and you die, I'm okay.
Fair enough. All right.
These people get weeded out.
So we end every episode talking about food.
Yeah.
And you've given us a preview, but what are you cooking right now?
Oh, well, I'm cooking birria, which is a Mexican a stew sort of thing, but I have a way to do it for tacos, and I'm going to make fancy beans with rice and peas and or rice with beans and with corn and beans, peas, and then fancy beans. And then I have a new recipe for melon, watermelon, cantaloupe, peaches, and all of that mixed together with some interesting stuff. And then, but I do have a new restaurant in Washington, which is fabulous. I was up there 2 weeks ago called Seven Reasons. And it is Argentinian or Venezuelan. I can't remember which. I think it's Venezuelan, actually. Young chef. They opened up in the fall of 2019, promptly were named one of the best restaurants in America, got a couple stars, I think one Michelin star, and then they had to close because of COVID. And then they reopened and did carry out, I think, and all the rest, and now they're physically open. And they're up in Northwest, kind of a little above Logan Circle, where I used to live, and three tiers in the restaurant. And it is without a doubt one of the best restaurants I have been in years. And the food is just absolutely perfect and unique. And you know, he does everything from seafoods to meats to. So if you're in Washington, try to get yourself a reservation in Seven Reasons.
Mm. All right. Very good.
They also have a fabulous soundtrack, by the way, which if you go to sevenreasonsdc.com, I think it's their website, you can download their soundtrack and put it on your
really?
Sonos. Yeah, your Sonos. That's or whatever. And it'll go for like 8 hours. And I do it for dinner parties.
Very, very cool. Yeah, that's yeah. interesting. I'm starting to see more people make Spotify playlists, you know, for places like that.
Totally.
All right. Rob Cortell, thank you so much for joining me here on The Swamp. Chris. We appreciate it.
Yeah, great time, Chris.
Bye-bye. All right, we'll see you tomorrow here on The Chris Spangle Show. Thank you for listening. And if you got something out of this, please share with your friends. That's the best way for us to grow. Thank you.